Hello, everyone, and welcome to the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, and I've been doing this podcast for a little, almost a year now. And if you've been listening, you know that Bridgeport, Pennsylvania is near Philadelphia, which means I am about an hour from the Atlantic Ocean. And I'm very excited because throughout these months of doing this podcast, talking with people from Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, moving out to the rest of the country, from Florida to Montana and Nevada, I'm now going further than ever before, all the way to the state of Alaska. This is going to be an exciting change of pace to learn about a place that most people listening have never been to, maybe never will, but it's very important. And my guest today is Andy Josephson, a legislator from Alaska. So, Andy, thank you for joining the podcast.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks for having me today. I look forward to it.
Good. So I appreciate you coming and talking today. It's around 4 o'clock my time. So what time is it there?
It's 12:18 p.m.
Oh, okay.
So we're 4 hours west.
It feels like you're going to be like 10 hours away.
Well, we used to be, for years as a child and young adult, we were 5 hours away. And then we changed that. We had multiple time zones. And now we have 2 in Alaska.
So I don't know a whole lot about Alaska, but I know that politics in Alaska is unique in ways that it's not like here. So what should people know about Alaska?
Well, in terms of its uniqueness, let me think about that. I would say that we have, I'm told, and I check, that we have more independents and nonpartisans than party-affiliated people, but I think that's not uncommon. We have quite a few libertarians. We've elected libertarians to the legislature in the past. We had a governor who was a member of a party in the early 90s called the Alaska Independence Party, and or the AIP, and technically one of its planks was secession or removal, I guess, from the United States, which was odd, of course, and noteworthy. The governor in question never really pushed any of that sort of thing. He used the AIP as a platform to run from. But I think there's a libertarian streak for sure. And, of course, just like nationally, that has a conservative and a liberal bent to it. But those are the main things that come to mind.
Now, what comes to mind to me is how Alaska looks. People I know have gone on cruises there. Some people have vacationed in general, and it's a beautiful state all over, right?
Yes, although it's so vast that it has lots of different topography and ecology and sort of geographical features. So some of it is tundra for sure, and sort of uplands. Some of it is coastal forest. It has the largest coastline. Well, it has a longer coastline than the rest of the United States combined. Some of it is Arctic. Some of it is absolutely not Arctic. And it's just vast. There's just a lot of it.
So, and
but
you...
Yeah, most of it is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, it's... I mean, just looking at any picture, whether it's the cities, the mountains, the shore, it feels like, and I know this is important to you, when you talk about protecting the environment of the planet or the country, the pictures you would pick from could be any photo of Alaska.
I think that's true because, so the first European to arrive came in 1741, so that's 250 plus years, approaching 275 or somewhere in there. And in some respects, the change from when he, Vitus Bering, arrived and now is vast. In other respects, not so much. So we have more intact sort of environmental areas than any other state, for sure. That's just got to be absolutely true. And in 1980, there was a federal law passed that sort of guaranteed that that should continue. It's in some respects a very, very pristine place. However, we have significant environmental issues, and there's been significant environmental harm done to Alaska, and I'd be happy to tell you about that.
Well, we have a little format here, but it's something I'm very concerned about. I have two young kids. I really care about the future of the climate and environment, which is one of the reasons I reached out to you, is because I've seen your profile. This is something you've focused on a lot in your legislative work and your political work, right?
It's something I focus on a huge amount and that I think about constantly. So I have other interests like labor, schools and universities, women's rights. There's a sort of, you know, healthcare to some degree. But first and foremost for me is my environmental ethic. And yes, I think I focus more on protecting Alaska's wildlife than any other legislator. I'm pretty confident that that's a true statement. And then I also have worked on assorted other environmental bills. And yeah, I sort of feel like I have a personal and moral obligation to keep Alaska as intact as possible. And that's sort of my operating theory, I guess you'd say.
So I was looking at your profile. You have been involved in politics in some way for a while, right? When did you first become politically involved?
So I grew up in a political family, and that always spurs one in that direction. So my father was in the legislature for 14 years, and I've been a sort of stalwart Democrat during all of that time. You know, I can remember in 1972, when I would have been eight, we had a big poster of McGovern in our home, and then I got to meet him in 1974. I met him a second time after that. So I grew up around this. I mean, my father worked for a Democratic senator from Alaska, one of our first, a guy named Bob Bartlett. And then my mother worked for Bill Proxmire from Wisconsin. They met on the Hill. And so I grew up in and around politics. I didn't run myself till I was 48, and now I'm 55. I had served on some municipal commissions and been a staffer in the legislature. So I think a lot about it, and I also have a history degree, so I tend to read a lot of biography and a lot of history and politics, so it's on my mind a lot.
And, well, you ran when you were 48, but there's not, unless you're 98, nothing against 98-year-olds, there's not necessarily a bad time to run for office, I assume.
I think that's true. You know, one of my colleagues who was elected the same year I was in 2012 was, I think, 24 when he filed, and maybe 23. And then I have another friend who was defeated, unfortunately, last year, but he's in his early 70s. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, it's obvious enough, but you need an opportunity, right? And so, and that comes through redistricting or appointment if someone unfortunately has passed away or quits effectively, or through some other electoral opportunity. And otherwise, if you're happy with who's representing you, you do other things.
Yeah, I've had people, especially since I've done this podcast and I'm in local office, say like, well, why aren't you running for state rep? I was like, well, I really like our state rep. I want him to be there for 20 years.
Right.
So is that what happened to you when you decided to run? There was an opportunity?
There was an opportunity. So it was redistricting. There's always a lag from the decennial period. So this was 2012, and the new district had been drawn, and there was a vacancy, essentially. And I ran. And I was at first very concerned because the Republican who challenged me was a well-known, extremely well-known local politician, pretty competent, basically a good guy, and I thought that I, frankly, was doomed. And I had to go through a period of real anxiety about that and come out the other end and say, no, this is okay, and prevailed in the end.
I think that's a thing that a lot of candidates face, is that doubt that, do you deserve this? And hopefully that means that you're a better person, whether it's you or someone else going through that, than someone that's just so sure of themselves.
Right.
You know, but I'm sure you've encountered that with other people, because you've encouraged other people to run as a result too, right?
I've encouraged other people to run, you bet, and sort of mentored them. And yeah, if you're asking me, do I prefer a humble person over an arrogant person? The answer is absolutely yes. And part of that is because even though I've been doing this for 7 years, you just can't know everything you should know.
Mm-hmm.
So that is, as I'd say it when I'm asked, it's both the joy and the sorrow of the job. It's joyful to be in this candy store of ideas and issues and concepts. It's also impossible to know it all, and you're technically supposed to. You're supposed to know about everything from, you know, barbers and hairdressers to mining and oil and gas to fisheries to, you know, public education, and it's just, you know, good luck trying to know it all.
Yeah, it's sometimes for me, like we had a budget hearing recently in our local council, which is far smaller than what you're doing. And I feel like, oh, I want to ask this question because I don't really know the answer, but then everyone's going to know that I don't know this thing. So I imagine there's a lot of people in politics, people in the public would be surprised that have that doubt about asking questions or not wanting to look like they don't know what's going on.
Yeah, that happens for sure. And so, you know, there are freshmen in particular who tend to be more reticent, and maybe that's okay. But, I think there's some people sort of empathize with that. And then the other thing is, traditionally, just almost accidentally, you'll have people interested in subjects A through E, and then someone else is interested in F through
right.
J, and someone, and so you help each other, and you share information and advise and mentor and that sort of thing.
Yeah, like I have, my state rep is really involved with healthcare issues and education. There's another person I know who's really involved in economic development issues. So they'll talk to each other about those different things to educate each other. And that helps a lot.
Yeah.
Now, we've seen in, what was the, you had to overcome that self-doubt to run a little bit. And not a lot, but, you know, you had to convince yourself and, you know, psych yourself up. Were there any other challenges for running for office or things that you found really joyful that you appreciated?
Yeah, I mean, so a typical legislative seat requires, you know, somewhere in the range of $40,000 to $250,000 if it's a competitive Senate seat. So you've got to find ways to raise that sort of money. However, I would say that if a person doesn't know a whole lot of the community, you can get there. In other words, you don't, at least at the state level, and this may be different, obviously, at Congress, but you can build those relationships quickly. And if you prove your merit and your bona fides, then generally the resources you need will come to you. You also have to deal with, if you've got a mortgage and children, that sort of thing, you have to find a way to bridge the gap in income while you're campaigning. It's tricky to be an effective campaigner and keep a full-time job.
Right.
And you also have to come to terms with the fact that you could lose, and then you've invested, you know, anywhere from 6 to 12 months, at least 3 or 4 months, and as much as a year in an unsuccessful enterprise. So you got to overcome all of that. Some people are nervous about public speaking. That wasn't really my nervousness for me because I'm a teacher and a lawyer, and so I was pretty comfortable with that. And you have to find a campaign team and volunteers, and you also have to, there's a theatrical part of this. So mm-hmm. sometimes I'm in an extroverted mood where I'm ready to take center stage, and other times I'm just from brain chemistry, I wake up pretty shy, and maybe I don't feel so self-assertive or self-assured, and yet I'm called on to be that. So you have to literally, it's like being an actor, and you have to, you're not faking or lying anything. You just have to put a smile on and speak confidently, even if you're not in the mood to. And it's just part of the job.
Now, one of the challenges, I wonder if it's unique to Alaska, is that it is separate from the rest of the country. You know, in most, in a lot of ways, literally. So, you know, here people are paying attention to legislatures in Wisconsin and North Carolina and Pennsylvania, whether it's because the redistricting's going to happen, or they see the kind of policies that are happening. They go through the states, they drive. So, you know, I go through New Jersey a lot. I do go to drive to New York a lot for family reasons in Rhode Island. Is it hard to get people to donate and support campaigns there that aren't from the rest of the country outside of Alaska?
Well, that's a really good question. So we have a state law that is pretty restrictive in terms of contributions. And in fact, the federal court took this up. It's now, I think, before the Ninth Circuit. The federal district court said that our restrictive limits, which were $500 per person, so I can, from a single human being, I can receive $500 per year. That's it. It's among the most restrictive in the country, that those were constitutional, but that's being challenged. There's also a limitation imposed by Alaska law that says you can't receive more than $3,000 from out of state. So I could go to Seattle and have a fundraiser, but I can't raise $4,000 there. I can only raise $3,000. And then we have limits of $1,000 from political action committees and unions per year. But what's happened on in statewide races, because of Citizen United and because of, you know, the divisiveness within the country, is that all the, that particularly the statewide races have become nationalized. So, for example, our current governor has a brother who donated $300,000 or $500,000 to his brother, that is our governor's campaign, and he was allowed to do that through a political action committee under our law. And you also see millions of dollars poured in similarly for statewide congressional races. So you know, money is much more important. And here's, this will be interesting for your audience, in school board races. So let's think about that for a second. These are, this is just the Anchorage municipality. This is not statewide. This is only about subjects that touch the school system, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
There was $40,000 of outside money that came from a right-wing PAC to bolster the effort of right-leaning candidates. Now, this was last year. This had never happened in Alaska history, ever. All of those races, all of those efforts from right-wing PACs failed. There is, you know, times are changing. So you see the national focus, for example, last week in the Virginia legislature, that was well publicized in the national media that the Democrats took over both chambers.
Mm-hmm.
So you see more and more of that happening.
Yeah, and is there a backlash, do you think, in Alaska when it feels nationalized, or is it just inevitable even there? Because, like you said at the beginning of this, Alaska is a very independent state, and, you know, I can see there people being like, I don't want to be like that.
Well, I think you make a good point that there is more backlash. It's hard for me to speak to because I've been an Alaska resident my whole life, so I'm not an expert on how it's viewed elsewhere. But when we use the word outside, O-U-T-S-I-D-E, outside, we capitalize in our writing the word, the letter O. So we refer to it, we give it like a proper noun, right? And so people will talk about the outside, or they talk about the lower 48. And that's the other. That is, you know, Alaskans don't like to be told what to do or when to do it. And so I think you're onto something. I think that that sort of help from outside can be a negative thing for a candidate, regardless of their party.
So I would hope that Alaska would be more independent than some of the things we've seen. But you know, you're in the legislature, you have been for years. And I mentioned Wisconsin and North Carolina. I've talked to people involved in state politics from those places. And the politics is so divisive there. Is it the same in Alaska now that you when you became an elected official? Has that changed in your 7 years there?
That's a fantastic question. So there is some tradition in Alaska of bipartisan coalitions. So, and that tradition is being practiced now, and I'll explain. But basically, you have some people, left and right, mostly right, however, who are, I guess, I don't mean this word too improperly, but they're sort of infected by the national culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're very Trumpian, et cetera. There are also some, I think, left-leaning people who, you know, they're more, perhaps, of the Alexander Ocasio-Cortez model than a more moderate Democrat. So you have that. But what you see in Alaska sometimes is people willing to leave the tribe and form coalitions. So that's what we've done in the House the last, it'll be going on 4 years next year. So even though Democrats by party have no business being in the majority in the House, they are. So this has been accomplished by a combination of the fact that there are now a couple independents who are in the legislature in the House, and also by essentially compacts or deals that are struck where more moderate Republicans, now they get something out of this, right? They get plum positions often, but they join the Democrats to form a coalition, and that's what's happened now. Now, part of what's made that possible now is that our governor, our new governor, Micah Dunleavy, is extremely right-wing. So he is more right-wing, I think almost provably true, than any governor in Alaska history. And he also, I talked about how outside, you know, we think of the other and we don't like the other. Well, that was true for Republicans too. So traditionally, a Republican governor couldn't be told by Republican-leaning institutions in the lower 48 what to do and how to do it. They would be offended by that because they were Alaskans first. Well, that's not happening now. So what you see is a number of Republicans, including some very conservative Republicans, are very upset with this new governor, and they are aligning themselves in unprecedented ways with Democrats. And often this is over questions, budgetary questions. So they are upset that the governor is willing to slash budgets as much as he is. And I could explain that in more depth if you'd like to hear about it.
Now, you know, I'm on, we're doing our budget presentation for our council because when you're in local government, you do your budgets at the end of the year. And I'm sure you know from your work there, it's really hard to cut budgets in a state government and local government, probably more true in state government because you're either using a scalpel here and there, or you have to cut something that is necessary. So what I imagine that in Alaska, the things that would be cut would be extremely necessary, right? So what's the thing that people should know?
Well, right, and what's happened is the governor, to give you a sense of this, okay, our operating budget for the state government is in the range of, depending on what we call the budget and how much of it is brought in by direct revenue, but essentially to make the state run, we need in the range of $4.5 billion. So just put that in your memory, $4.5 billion. The governor's proposal has been to cut $1.5 billion of that. And it is absurd. It's absolutely absurd. So how would he do that? Well, he was going to cut about a sixth of K-12 funding. He was going to cut about a third of the University of Alaska's funding. And the list just goes on and on and on. He was going to make us one of only about five states without pre-K programs. He was going to do all sorts of things. So, and some of the things that he wanted to cut are absolutely affordable. So the one I highlight a lot is adult dental programs through Medicaid. So poor and disabled people who qualify for Medicaid have been receiving what's called an optional program, which is dental coverage, and they've been receiving this for free because of their status. And what he said was, this is elective, we don't want to do this anymore, and when their teeth abscess and become infected, they'll still get coverage at the emergency room. Well, yes, they will, but they'll lose the tooth often, and they'll be in pain, and it'll be more costly. Well, that didn't matter to the governor. So he was okay cutting this program, and the program cost the state $8 million. And because we didn't fund the $8 million, actually we did, but he vetoed it, and we couldn't override the veto, we lost $19 million in federal match. So that means there's $27 million less spent on dental care for 31,000 people. Now, what was the point of this? I mean, what was shocking about it is it just was unnecessary. We identified the $8 million. We appropriated the $8 million. All it did was upset people. It upset the providers. It upset the patients. But that's what he wanted to do. And the problem, Tony, that we've run into is we have the toughest burden to overcome to override a veto of any state in the union. So many states, you need one more than half of the legislature to say, bad veto, we're going to override the veto. Or you need two-thirds. In Alaska, we need three-quarters.
Oh, wow.
So that makes the minority extremely powerful. And I have to, so there's 60 of us in the legislature total. I need to gather 45 votes to override a veto. He needs to gather 16. Because if he gets 16, I only have 44, and he wins. And this is something that was put in our Constitution way back in 1955, and it's becoming an insurmountable thing to work with. And so it makes this governor very, very powerful.
And I can imagine that those kind of cuts, especially to healthcare or education, well, especially to healthcare, you know, if you cut healthcare or something in Pennsylvania, I like my home, my family likes it here, but if we need to, we can move to Maryland, we can drive to New Jersey, we can drive to Ohio from the other side of the state, New York. It would be hard, but not that hard to move. But your residents, especially people who depend on those programs, when you cut something like that, what do they do?
Well, this is a very good point, Tony, and the governor noted, and I want to be fair to him on this, he implied that the world we lived in 1965, when there were about 300,000 Alaskans, and now we have 730,000, there might have been 350,000, somewhere in that range, was a world or a size of government he wanted to return to. And he said as much. He cited to our population in the mid-60s. Yet he has a mantra that is, quote, open for business, close quote. But I can tell you that the business community is up in arms about harm he's causing to the economy needlessly by all of these vetoes. And the result of that has been that there is a very significant, most significant in state history, for sure, recall effort. And there's litigation about whether the T's have been crossed, the I's dotted in that recall effort. But there is a very strong and conservative effort going on right now to remove the governor.
Wow. I'm glad that I'm able to bring some attention to this because, like I've been saying, people don't notice it. And it's just as important as any other state. And one of the things that's important about Alaska, to move back to what we started at the beginning, is the environment of Alaska, something you've been talking a lot about there. Because you guys see the challenges and the pitfalls and everything that's happening with the environment, particularly in Alaska, right?
Yes.
So
yes, we do. And part of that is because of the contrast, right? So when you've got something that is perfect, clean and untrammeled, and someone harms it, you see it, you notice it.
So, you know, I'm in Pennsylvania. When we have, if the weather, if the climate change a little bit in Pennsylvania, we wouldn't notice too much. People are like, oh, it was warm on Christmas this year, which it has been. What should people know about in Alaska, and maybe even be very concerned about?
Oh boy. Well, let me tell you what I'm doing right now. I'm sitting in my office in the middle of Anchorage, and I'm looking out at the mountain range nearby, which are called the Chugach Mountains. And there is very, very little snow at about the 3,000 foot level. They are 4,000 feet high. There is no snow on the ground in Anchorage. We had no snow. I can tell you that as a kid growing up here, you generally had snow in September. And we also do not have sub-freezing temperatures. That didn't happen as a kid. It is currently outside right this minute raining in Anchorage. So this blizzard that's going on, affecting, according to the national news, 200 million people in America, it is very comfortable right here in Anchorage. Very, very comfortable. And this is not normal. This summer, Anchorage at the airport hit 90 degrees Fahrenheit. That never would happen as a kid. It's unlikely you'd hit 80 degrees. We have had thunder showers and lightning in Anchorage. That absolutely, absolutely never happened to me growing up here in the 60s and 70s. Unheard of. We have a lot of land with permafrost under the ground, and that permafrost is shifting and melting, and it makes our infrastructure suffer as a consequence. So you get heaves and undulation in the highways and roads. You get buildings that no longer are stable. You have all of those issues. Then you also are seeing for the first time in Alaska die-offs of creatures that we depend on, like seals, right? So most of your listeners wouldn't think or be allowed to harvest a seal, but our native Alaskans are allowed to by law, and most of us, even conservationists like myself, are fine with that, typically, or relatively fine with it. And they are dying from unusual deaths at ages they're not supposed to die. We have mass bird die-offs on beaches. Inexplicable. We have salmon who do not move upstream to spawn. They essentially have died of heat stroke. So we are the canary in the coal mine, and this is well known. I mean, you know, Greenland went through this as well. So the entire northern hemisphere, in particularly the Arctic, showed evidence of this, and you know, it's very concerning. We have our state sport, which is dog mushing, has been impacted by this because there's not enough snow to mush on. It's turning Alaska into this sort of bizarre place. So we're profoundly concerned about it.
And you know, for a lot of people in the lower 48, as you referred to us, they see some things on the news about Alaska being warmer, and to someone, again, in Pennsylvania might say, oh, good for them. It must be terrible living where it's cold all the time. See, global warming is good, right? Like now in Alaska, they can have a moderate summer or spring, but they don't realize the huge repercussions happening here.
Sure. So they're economic and they're social and societal. You know, the other thing is they're causing massive wildfires. So while the temperature was, some would say, comfortable, although most Alaskans don't, unless there are a couple spots where it was traditionally hot, like Fairbanks in the interior. But, you know, most Alaskans don't really want it to be 80. They want it to be 72, right? They certainly don't want it to be 90. But they would prefer sort of the 70 to 75 for their own comfort. But this summer they were breathing through, you know, screens of smoke, right, and wearing masks because the fires were so profoundly bad to the north of the city and the south of the city of Anchorage, and they were wreaking havoc on the citizens there, right? So, you know, buildings burned out, schools closed, highways impassable. It is. No, this is not what we have in mind when we think about the kind of environment we choose to live in. This is not what we have in mind.
And I'm sure it's not the thing that people have in mind when they think to go to Alaska. So, like I said, I've known people who've gone on cruises to Alaska. They say it's one of the most beautiful cruises you can take. And so does that impact tourism and people coming to visit?
Well, it would impact winter tourism, and we have some of that. I don't know how much it impacts summer tourism, unless because of the fires, people weren't flying up here. But, you know, I'm reminded that in 1992 and 1994, Anchorage was the pick city for the United States for the Winter Olympics. Well, those are traditionally held in February, and hopefully we'll have snow by February. But right now, you couldn't ski in Anchorage. There's no snow. So, you know, that's just another illustration of how odd this all is.
Yeah, like you said, the canary in the coal mine. And it is very concerning because you see the evidence firsthand, and unfortunately a lot of other people who are policymakers in the country don't see it.
Right.
Now,
invasive species is another factor, by the way.
Oh, so yeah. So how is that?
The speed of sort of the increase in invasive species.
And so you might, like I said, people can't easily move from Alaska to another state, but animals can move from Canada and other places to and from Alaska. So that I can see decimating a lot of species that are interstate. So, with that in mind, you see that there are some very serious issues in Alaska, things that people don't know about, that many of them that could happen in any state in the country. Why would you encourage more people to run for office?
Well, I mean, I think mainly for one of the reasons I highlighted a few minutes ago, and that is just the, as I call it, the potpourri of issues. So, you know, it's not required. We can all have the number of interests that we want to have. But for the profoundly curious person, the legislature is just is endlessly interesting. It's just interesting. You know, the way I describe it, I was talking to a candidate the other day, is if somebody wanted, I'll use indigenous invasive species as an example. If someone were interested in invasive species and they were a legislator, a freshman legislator, the world would literally open up for them. That is, they could attend national conferences at really taxpayer expense on invasive species. They could use the research arms of the Legislative Research Office to do it, and the lawyers that we have to draft legislation. They could write op-eds in their local paper, and because they have a status as a legislator, they would be listened to. They could literally make the world come to them, and the net result would be their coalition or caucus would treat them as the expert. Oh, we got to go ask Senator Smith because he's been working on this. And so it's sort of like free education. It's like attending university, picking any class you want at no cost. And so you know, that's a wonderful thing. You also get the joy of public service. You can help people with, you know, their potholes and their curb cuts and all of those things. You can also act as an ombudsman or a caseworker on individual problems a person has accessing their government. So that's an amazingly satisfying thing. And you can take your passion and turn it into a bill that that could become law for a very, very, very long time, if not forever. And you can also steer the dialogue. So, for example, I have legislation banning plastic bags in Alaska. Well, before I filed that, Anchorage had no prohibition on plastic bags. Well, I like to think that my interest and my vocalization on this issue created some other interest, and now in the largest city in Alaska, you cannot buy or use a plastic bag when you go grocery shopping. So you can create an atmosphere where that sort of dialogue and information is disseminated.
You know, listening to you, I appreciate your story. It does make me think that there's probably a lot of other people out there who think, you know, I care about X, but I don't know anything about A through W. But I'm frustrated that no one in politics is dealing with X. they should run for office because, like you said, it could be a learning experience and they could get something done on an issue that maybe no one that is in the legislature knows about. So you may only know X, but X might be the thing that no one else is an expert on. So if there's one thing you're passionate about, make that the reason you run.
I think that's absolutely true. And the other thing is, you know, I thought if you were going to, this almost sounds like a science fiction comment, but if you were going to build a legislator or congressman from the ground up, right, so a new baby's born and we're going to just focus on making this the best politician or public servant possible, they would have knowledge of medicine, they might be a doctor, they might be an accountant, they might be a laborer, they might be a carpenter, they might be a lawyer, they might be a tradesman, right, they might be an educator. They might be a natural resources specialist. And so what makes a great legislature is you need some of all of those talents. And so, you know, in that respect, we need each other to get this job done.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that I may be on the East Coast, and you may be on the far, far West Coast, but we still need each other to combat issues of government impropriety, bad budgets, and climate change. Thank you, Andy, for running for office.
Sure,
and hopefully inspiring.
You.
And I hope that other people are inspired too, whether you live in Alaska or anywhere else in the country or the world, because I have had a listener from New Zealand. I hope that you consider running for office too. Andy, before I go, how can people follow you and learn about more about Alaska?
Well, I have a website, Representative Andy Josephson, on Facebook. And then if they're interested in what's going on in Alaska, you know, I encourage them to look at the Anchorage Daily News, which provides great coverage. And if they're interested more specifically in the legislature itself, if they Google the word BASIS, B-A-S-I-S, space Alaska, BASIS Alaska, they would get into our legislative website, and from there they could let their fingers do the talking and click on all sorts of things related to our legislation, for example, and the members of the legislature.
Great. If you're listening, do not sleep on Alaska. It is awesome. There are great people. There are great views. And it is an important part, not just of our country, but of the planet. Thank you, Andy, for being on the podcast. And if you're listening, maybe you'll be inspired to run for office, too.